According to the repeater handbook, there's probably about 200 repeaters in the UHF, VHF range in the metropolitan area. But really speaking, there's only about 10 that are active and operational and being used regularly. Limark is one of them. So actually, I put together a short list of local repeaters in the area. I call it the Hitchhiker's Guide to New York City Repeaters. And it's available at www.hqrp.com. So that'll give you a list, at least in the metropolitan area, because I live in the metropolitan area. So it does give you as good information about Suffolk County and such, because I'm a little out of range of that. So, you know, I mean, you kind of go through something like that and collect a bunch of frequencies and program your handy talkies and squirrel the knob every so often and take a good listen. You'll probably want to favor the stations that are more active over the daytime than less active. There are repeaters that have a couple conversations a day, but there are other repeaters that have a lot of conversations all day, and some go through the night. So those are a couple of very simple options. Now, if you decide that you'd like to try out HF, your license does allow for a 10-meter operation. I have a 10-meter test every Sunday morning on 28.380 upper sideband, which is in the technician's license availability. So, you know, if you get yourself an inexpensive 10-meter radio, you can try your hand at HF. Or if you want to use things called web SDRs, you can listen in on internet-based radio receivers and listen to the high-frequency band. Get an idea of whether HF is for you, or you prefer keeping on the UHF and VHF band.
Great stuff. Thank you so much. This is KDZU-CYN. Thank you so much.
Okay, very good, Harry. I wish you good luck on the hobby. It's a great hobby. It is very deep and very wide. There are 50, 60, 70 different technologies that you can pick from. UHF, VHF, FM is one. Digital, sideband, amplitude modulation, all kinds of fields, satellite, ISS, moonbound, you name it, it's all over the place. You can go to the depths or you can ride the surface. So if one aspect of the hobby doesn't interest you, there's 20 others to choose from. So I wish you good luck, Harry. And of course, be here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Don't be a stranger. If you have any questions, feel free to come by and... So, once again, this is ACDGS, which is Limark Technical Network. We are looking for questions, topics, and discussions. If anyone has anything out there, tell me which question or your comment is.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, Jeff. I mentioned Jeff earlier. He's the net control operator for the Papa Network's antenna test net every Friday night at 10 o'clock local time on Papa Network. What would you like to say, Jeff, tonight?
Okay, thank you, Roy. I should mention also, if you want to get to the antenna, go to my QRZ page and show you what modes you can use to get to the antenna net, because they're multi-mode with, you know, DMR, D-Star, P25, and All-Star. And that has all the information you need to get there, and we're there every Friday night at 10 p.m. your time. I was going to make a comment earlier, Roy, on the coil coax. And one of the things to watch out for, which I think has happened to me, is if you have the both ends of the coax are touching, you know, you can essentially end up pretty much having the, you know, common mode leaking over, and then end up, you know, bypassing the coil. That's something to watch out for. So I actually had that happen to me. I thought I mentioned that. AB6MB.
Okay, that's very good to point out. I mean, lately I've been watching a lot of YouTubes of guys who do a lot of antenna simulation and a lot of technical stuff, and a lot of them really dislike the whole concept of an air core coil as an RF choke. It seems to, you know, they have a sense that it doesn't really give you enough of an inductive reactive to be of value. And as you mentioned, there are ways for it to go wrong. And depending upon the expense you're putting into coax cables, it could be a rather expensive waste of a good length of coax cable. What they seem to really like is toroid. You get yourself a relatively inexpensive big ferrite toroid. You wrap a coax cable with two windings around it, and their suggestion is that that will produce significantly better inductive reactive to block common mode current. So something to keep in mind. I use a slightly different method that is probably not as cost effective. Most of my RF chokes are a series of about six rather large snap-on ferrites that I do. I put them end-to-end, and then I take a weatherproof heat-shrink tubing and shrink them onto the coax or the lead point. You pay a little bit more for all those ferrite snap-ons, but to me it's kind of a little bit easier to do. But, the toroid is less expensive and probably less heavy, so you have a lighter drag on your coax.
Yeah, I totally agree on that. I have something else to point out. I have an ICOM 7300, and I use an N-FET antenna, so I don't have the best blocking common mode current. So what I was finding when I was using QWERTY, it would get RF into my radio, you know, actually my laptop. And so what I ended up doing was I took the USB cable, just some USB cable I had laying around, and I ordered a USB cable that had toroids in it for use with printers. And I got that in the mail, and then I plugged it into my radio and into my laptop, and then no more RFI. So I highly recommend the use of a printer cable with toroids for USB. I'm saying it all back. A USB cable with toroids in it for printers, AB6MB.
Okay, that's a good idea, Jeff. Sometimes I'm fortunate and I get USBs that have built-in ferrites. Other times, clamp ferrites are relatively inexpensive. You can buy from a known retailer because you want to get the proper mix. There are mixes that work better for HF and mixes that work worse for HF. So if you want a known brand and a legitimate mix number. But these clamps, you can buy individual clamps and clamp your own USB cables, and they work just as well as the ones that are built directly with ferrites. Ferrites are relatively inexpensive, and there's no such thing as too many ferrites. I've put ferrites all over my equipment, and especially I have a lot of radios and it's radio equipment that goes that has USB control. And so both ends of the USB cable I have ferrite clamps on. So ferrites are certainly a cheap, relatively cheap, very easy solution to improve the RF feedback.
Yep, I totally agree with that. You know, I have toys clamped on everything. If it moves, I clamp it. No, I'm just kidding, but it's almost like that at times. Okay, well, I just wanted to add my 2 cents there. Thanks for doing the net. 8670.
Well, thank you for participating, thank you for coming here, and thank you for the popper and cat attack. That's a very good test, and I recommend it to everyone. Now, I'll give you another precautionary tale that I have not personally discovered, but the same people who poo-poo with Air Corps inductors as RF chokes also are not that pleased with the clamp on ferrite. Their problem is that if you kind of get the grime and dust and dirt into the edges, when you seal them up, they don't make a proper connection, and there's a gap in the magnetic field that allows the ferrite to be less efficient in producing a high impedance. I have not noticed that, but then I don't have grimy ferrite clamps. They're kind of shiny and smooth. I keep them clean, so they have never been a particular problem for me. But in the back of your mind, if you like to use a ferrite clamp, just to take a quick look and make sure that the one you're using are free of any dirt and debris, and that you don't have an air gap between the two sides when the clamping together. Any comments about ferrites or RF chokes or any of that? I mean, most of the problems that we can have once we finally figure out how to put an antenna up is how to deal with RF in the shack. I've looked at schematics to be able to detect the amount of common mode coming back on coax cables, and I'm considering putting something together, doing a couple of experiments, but you know, getting the RF out of the jack, especially these days where there's computers and stuff. I guess in the old days, what would happen is maybe your garage door opener would turn on, or something very weird would happen, but nowadays, any kind of stray RF near a computer and set a device and do all kinds of wonky things. Anyone with any comments and or questions on this particular subject, please feel free. Okay, well, once again, I see we're in the doldrums. It's a quiet, dark days of summer. And I once again hope that once Labor Day starts to come on, more people show up and or ask questions. But still, you know, as I mentioned before, the questions and comments that are the great for this 10-minute meal. So, out there, if you have any questions, comments to the technical nature, science related, what have you, feel free to send us a talk button and take a seat. Quiet is evident. I'll give you one more chance. If you got any questions or comments, if you want to break through the technical net, I guess otherwise we'll do a couple of stories from the Science Talk column. We can still keep them alive. If not on the technical net, every week I put together a list of interesting science stories, and on my web page, which is roy.hcc.com. But they're always in the front of my screen. If it's a case of a problem, break glass, which is a lead article. So, guys, if you don't have a question or a comment, we'll do some science talk articles. But anyone out there with any questions or comments, please just ask me. I couldn't make out a word, so if you can maneuver the antenna in a better position near a window or tilt it in a different direction or increase the gain, that would be great. Okay, what's your first name? Okay, David, do you have a question or a comment for tonight? Unfortunately, you're about 50% noise. It's kind of difficult for me to make out all of it. You mentioned something about lithium iron phosphate. I really do like that technology. I have a few of them. They have a good set of qualities. They have a great number of recycles they're capable of, and their voltage declines at a slower rate than things like lead-acid steel batteries. I'm not quite sure you mentioned something about noise, but I didn't quite make it out. So if you could rephrase, maybe I could understand it better. Probably wouldn't have that much of an effect. I mean, the only thing that would take out of the equation is the power supply. If you were getting RF in through the power supply, the regulators or something, by using a battery, you kind of take all that out of the equation. I don't think, unless you have a particular problem with the power supply, that will make a difference one way or the other. Oh, okay. Yeah, probably. You'll probably have better altitude. The old joke about UHF, VHF is three golden rules. It's altitude, altitude, and altitude. Okay, unfortunately, that was all noise to me, so I couldn't make that out. My location is Staten Island. Oh, okay. Who knows? Probably if I listened to you on the input, it would sound better. You want to give it a try, and I'll try and listen you on the input, because I'm in Brooklyn. Okay, I tried. I couldn't get you quite on my input, so I guess although you're in Staten Island and I'm in Brooklyn, we're probably a distance apart. Okay, very good, David. Glad to hear you. Hope you come back and we'll talk again. Jet, here I is, ATCCS, Roy, with the Limar Technical Manager. Anyone has any questions or comments tonight, please feel free. If you can talk, just tell me what you got.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Griff. What can I do you for today?
Well, somebody mentioned battery technology. I was wondering if you were at all familiar with grid-level storage, batteries and such.
Yeah, so we've talked about it before, and unfortunately, I was very forgetful, but I did see the video. Chris showed me a video where a group of people, of the college professor and his graduate students, have worked out an interesting means to store a lot of energy at places that are only able to generate at certain times of the day, like the wind energy and solar energy and such. And apparently they're using, if I remember correctly, magnesium, liquid magnesium, and liquid, I think antimony, liquid antimony in a liquid salt solution under high temperature, and are able to recharge those types of batteries and discharge them when the energy source recharging them goes down. That's interesting technology, and important technology, because a lot of renewable energy are not dependable 24/7. So yeah, that's a very big, interesting field that's going to be increasing in its development over the years, with the onset of a lot more of these intermittent power supplies like solar cells and wind power.
It would seem that it's the missing link in really taking intermittent power, solar and wind and such, more viable.
Yeah, it is certainly an important part of the puzzle. They'll have to see whether it scales up well. Some technologies work very good in small scale, but as you scale them up, other problems crop up. So certainly it is an important development that requires more research and development. I don't know exactly how much solar power can be generated in the country. It's a perpetual thing that people go about. They like the old-fashioned carbon spewing technologies on one end, and other guys talk about how fusion is just around the corner. Just 10 years. Just around the corner for 10 years for the last 50 years. So I'm sure there's going to be people swayed by the new technology, but yeah, it's very good that people are working on it. It's an important
Okay. Yeah, well, I was amazed with solar panels. I mean, I had solar panels put onto the house about 2 years ago, and it's anywhere between 60 and sometimes as high as 80% of my electrical load. Just from those panels. So it's quite remarkable.
Well, yeah, but unfortunately, different areas of the country, different weather patterns have a massive impact on it. And, the lifespan of solar cells can be a problem. There's a degree of maintenance if you want optimal output. So, there's a lot of guys making back of the envelope measurements, setting up these enormous solar farms in the middle of the deserts of New Mexico and Arizona and such. And although it sounds exciting, you start doing the mathematics of everything that needs to be put around them and how to shuttle the energy on a non-existent electrical grid that needs to be built as well, it's developed problems. But you know, individual people, especially when you get a tax break when you install them, that's good. Utility companies will never kind of let anyone sell them back electricity. I think that you know, that may be something. But right now, people in other areas where they produce over 100% of their energy for some portions of the day, I would really love to feed it back to the grid. But the utility companies feel that they don't want to risk their grid on output of an individual solar panel people. So it'll never quite be that nice. But yeah, solar batteries are very useful. They're surprisingly inefficient. Most people kind of don't really understand how, you know, it's just a couple of percent efficiency. It would be really nice if that could be improved. There's a lot of people working on it every day. So hopefully they'll figure out something to make those solar cells even more efficient than they presently are, or at least extend their life expectancy, or decrease their production costs.
Yeah, well, you know, I think all of those things are on the way. I think the efficiency is somewhere in the range of about 15%. But you know, a lot of energy is going, 15% that would otherwise be going to waste. The initial cost obviously is is something. But my electric bill went from over $200 down to about $20 a month on average.
Wow, that's great. I really haven't talked to that many people that have actually put up solar cells and gotten back, what's the savings and benefits. When you factor in those, the cost for having it installed and such, how many years would it take to pay off that investment?
It's about 4 years.
Oh, that's pretty good. Well, yeah, probably the tax benefits help a lot.
Yeah, that's true. The tax benefits certainly do help a lot. As you know, it's a city, state, and federal. Certainly does help to offset the cost. But yeah, the payback is about a little over 4 years in my case, the way I calculate it. I was really pleasantly surprised.
Not very good. I mean, offhand, I don't think anyone has solar cells in my neighborhood. Not that I've asked everyone, but I've certainly done Google Earth enough times to be able to hear on their roofs that there's nothing that looks like a solar panel on my particular block. But maybe I should kind of scope out Google Earth side views around the neighborhood to see if there's anything interesting.
Yeah, the limitation from the utility was basically they looked back, for a 2 year period, and the limit of panels that you could install would, total no greater than 105% of your energy.
Oh, okay. I guess that sort of makes sense, because they don't want to deal with any of your excess energy. So as long as you keep it below that level, they don't have to concern themselves.
Well, in essence, I mean, you have what's called a smart meter. So
interesting, by the way, the TV. So they give you credit if you could theoretically pour power back into the grid, and they give you credit for that?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a smart meter, so the meter, you know, the meter runs in both directions. So, you know, the size when you're producing more than you're consuming, and then, you know, the meter is basically running backwards, and you're piling up credit. And then, you know, when you get a cloudy day or a rainy day, you're not producing, then you're using that power. But with the system that I have, there's no point where they'll ever send you a check.
Okay, understood. I thought that the utility companies were kind of infamous for not wanting people to put power back into the grid. And they were very possessive about the technical aspects of grid power. They didn't want to go in the opposite direction. I guess I have to do more reading on that.
That's why they limit, the total wattage of your panel can't be greater than 105%. So, you realize, of course, it's not every day it's going to be bright and sunny, so you're never going to produce more power. If I get an electric car, then I could probably get some more panels.
Okay, very good. And also, it's a seasonal thing in this area. It's less seasonal down south, but I have little devices in my backyard that recharge my solar batteries. And in the very, very middle of winter, when the sun is shortest, you can't keep the charge. I have to put a battery on the market. So I would assume you get less power out in those kinds of short days. Lithium chemical fire as opposed to the usual sources. fire. So that's one thing you don't have to worry about, this thing overheating. It's still hot. So, very good. You know, I hope it works out, and I hope it becomes part of our multi-pronged solution to dealing with energy shortage without pouring out carbon dioxide into the air.
Yeah, very true. Okay, JD2WOT, thank you very much, Roy. Appreciate the comment.
And thank you for participating. Once again, it's JD2GS, thank you, Roy. This is the Lime on Technical Medicine. Here every Sunday night at UCF. Talk about technology, science, and all kinds of fun things. So, once again, if anyone out there is still applying, question or comment, hit that push to talk button. Well, I guess. Quiet night. Maybe we should just leave it a quiet night. We'll give you, I'll give you one more time. If not, hopefully Paul will just do his SpaceNet report a little bit earlier. We'll call it a night a little bit earlier. I think the chat room is kind of very quiet as well. We have a whole bunch of people listening on the stream, the internet stream. Echo link, but I get the feeling everyone's in a sort of a passive pose. So, one last shot. Anyone has any questions of the technical nature, comments to make tonight, please give that push to talk about.
Alpha, Delta 2, Delta Uniform, coming in on Echo link.
Oh, okay. Hello, Alex. Do you have any questions or comments tonight?
Yeah, if you're operating mobile with one of the LifePO batteries, when do you need a watt? Like, when do you need them, or is it a voltmeter? And do you need to have it in line between the radio and the back? 82 to you.
Okay, so what I think you're getting at is you have a battery that's discharging, and you would like to have an indication when you should start to recharge it rather than keep using it. Under those particular circumstances, you would want to have a voltmeter in parallel with your power connector to your radio and look for the decline in the voltage and decide at what the voltage to pull it out and recharge it again.
Does it hurt the radio to if you if the battery runs down a little bit? Or it's like, do you need it in that sense? Or will the radio just stop working?
It would never be a good idea to leave your battery to discharge to such a voltage where your radio starts to malfunction. We sort of chatted about that on the TechNet about a month ago, that at a certain low level, your CPU, your processor chip, simply reboots your radio over and over again. But even before the obvious, as you lower the voltage beyond a certain spec, you're going to have internal modulation distortion. You're going to have not the greatest function of your radio. So you can easily look at the specifications of your radio for the optimum voltage. Occasionally, you will get a range, so that's something to go with. It says that it's built to operate with 13.8. That's fine. If it says 13.8 plus or minus 5 volts or something, because the lithium ion phosphate, the voltage will descend more slowly than, say, lead acid. But lead acid kind of gets very bad very quickly when it really gets discharged. So you can look at the specified range for your radio, and when your voltmeter is reading that the voltage that the battery is putting out is getting close to the low end of acceptable, that would be a good time to recharge. You can damage your radio by repeatedly operating it at below the proper voltage. You can do even worse things by operating it above its recommended voltage, but you can still do damage with a low voltage if you keep on doing it.
Got it. It sounds like you can get away without using it, because it's just one extra thing to do, so long as you keep the battery pretty charged. 82 to you. I'll be clear.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's sort of a belt and suspenders. Offhand, I don't know too many people who plug in voltmeters and keep looking at them. They just use batteries, and when they're done for the day, they take the batteries out and put them in the charger. You usually get a kind of a sense of how far your the battery capacity will go. I mean, most anti-talkies and such work like that as well. I would make a habit of running really low on the voltage. If you're the type of person who kind of waits until the radio fails, it's probably not the best practice, but, you know, if you regularly take the batteries out and charge them at the end of each day, unless you're doing a hell of a lot of transmitting, chances are you're probably not going to have the problem. Okay, thanks, Alex, for your questions. You know where to find us. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. So once again, this is ACPGS. I'm on technical method. If anyone else has any comments about what we were discussing or any questions about anything else, please just ask for some more questions. Okay, it's 9:45, a little early for this, but nevertheless, I guess everyone's a week of tired, and over the summer, and through the summer, what have you. Paul, would you like to do the SpaceNet report a little bit early tonight?
WSUN, no problem. Yeah, we can do that. And if anybody has a technical question, just chime in. Before I will get back to you. Yeah, no problem. I can do that for you.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, maybe since I got on early, everybody started let me look up the news and see what's really going on. Maybe they got it on the NASA site. In fact, they just had a replay of one of the news conferences with all the different companies and countries that are involved with this project. You heard me earlier talk about the SLS baseline system. They call the whole setup the Artemis mission, instead of the Apollo mission, the Artemis mission. on the moon. Artemis 4 will have a bigger second stage right now. This second stage pushes around 25,000 pounds of thrust. When you get to Artemis 4, it'll have four times that number. It's probably a little short of 100,000 pounds of thrust, so they're going to have four of the same engines. And the engines that they use are, they're smart in what they did. All these parts are quite derived from other missions and other older technologies. It's just been upgraded. So they know everything's safe. Through its space, 42 days, it takes the second stage. Right now, it's called the interim cryogenic propulsion stage. With the one engine, it's called the OMS engine, OMS. That engine is derived from the space shuttle. Not the big main engines on the space shuttle, the RS-25. They're using them on the very bottom of the core stage. We have four of those engines. They put out about 500,000 pounds each. But the ultimate rocket engine is attached to I don't want to go up on I don't want to get too involved. Anyway, you have the second stage, and the internal propulsion stage I'm talking about. Eventually, I will have a four engine simplified in that one. Four engines. Those engines have been used for decades. Rocket diving, and it's called RL-10. The other one is the old engines that came from the space shuttle. In the orbit, there's two engines located in the back, up high on the shuttle. One on the left and one on the right. They're called the old engines. Everything they use is different fuel. Hydrazine, it's truly hydrazine gas, the longer name for that. Hydrazine is mixed with nitrogen, hexoxide, which is the oxide. But they're proven, they flew on 135 missions. So when the European Space Station got the contract to do the service module of the Orion, that's the one that's going to actually send them back to the moon, and it's going to be able to fire over and over again, because the shuttle won't send it, moves on it, they use it today. So we'll see how it all goes. They have a stack of 322 feet high system. Hopefully at 10:33 in the morning, and they have a 2-hour window, so if there's a delay, it will delay for 2 hours. After that, then they have to be a different day. The next day would be September 2nd. That'll be a different problem. September 2nd, they have to go September 5th. And if that's going to work out, then they have to bring the whole rocket back to the vehicle assembly building. Rework the thing, including the FTS flight termination system. That's the one that actually blow up the rocket in case there was a problem. They hook up the batteries. The batteries are only lead, so required sign that they last 25 days. When they're installed in the vehicle assembly building, they roll out the pad, and it's just, I think, a week, another, who knows how many days before they launch. But if that goes off 25 days collectively, that's if they have to bring it all the way back assembly building to change out the battery system. And then, so it doesn't get off the ground tomorrow morning, 2nd of September, 5th of September. It's wait all the way to October. Well, and they have, as I mentioned earlier, they have 10 CubeSats that are going to be released after the separation. After it launches, you have the two solid booster rockets that separate. Remember that from the shuttle days. And then the core stage brings it to 52.5 miles. And then, of course, space shuts down, and especially deorbits, and that winds up in the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And then, after that, the internal cryogenic propulsion system that pushes the vehicle all the way to the moon. And then that thing separates. Now Orion is by itself. Orion is considered the space capsule itself, which holds actually 4 people, 8 people. And then that has the service module attached to that. And that in turn will eventually be able to fly a couple of times. That's what it is to get it to orbit around the moon and eventually bring it back to Earth. So, we'll see if this all comes together. We have the mannequin zoo. There's 3 of them on board. Well, they said 10,000 sensors are attached to the 3 mannequins. I'm not sure why they have so many, but vibration, radiation, temperature, humidity. What it's like inside of the space suit. So they're going to get all that telemetry back. It's going to be great. And once they get all the telemetry of this whole launch, 42 days, they're going to be able to see, for instance, how many reusable parts that they can use for future missions. You know, right now it's in the hundreds, and they predict the next mission or two. They might have as many as 5,000 reusable parts. This cuts the cost down. They're going to have a mission every year. Right now they have missions planned out to Artemis 9. But you know, get Artemis 1 off the ground first. It's a much bigger spacecraft than Apollo. Should I need WS2N? For instance, the diameter is roughly 16 feet, a little over 16 feet. To measure the diameter of the heat shield, mass measure the diameter of the heat shield of the Apollo system, it's roughly 12 feet. And also the height difference is much higher with Orion, so you're going to be able to carry comfortably 4 people on Orion to the back, where Apollo has 3 people. You know, let's say if you stripped out the whole inside of Orion, you could actually fit an Apollo spacecraft inside Orion. You can idea of the size of the thing. And the other manned spacecraft that we're working on is the Starliner by Boeing. You know, that's got a pretty good width too, but not as big. It's almost 15 foot category. SpaceX is smaller, shy of 12 feet. About 12 feet. So, there you go. If anybody has any questions before I continue. Go on to a couple of other topics that I had here. I know, keeps me awake at night. Last couple of weeks, following the automatic rollout in vehicle assembly building location. In fact, we got hit with lightning, not the spacecraft itself, but the towers. You know, if you look at these things, they look like radio towers surrounding the vehicle. Four huge towers. In fact, it's 600 feet tall. They're almost twice the size of the Autobus launch vehicle. Autobus is 322 feet. It's like 600 feet tall. Anyway, they get zapped by lightning. No effect. No effect to the spacecraft whatsoever. That happened a few days ago. Today we have to watch for weather. It's being an acceptable weather for small planes. That's okay. A couple other topics I had was an astronaut called Frank Rubio. He has a small head, small back on. Home to fly on the Soyuz rocket. It's going to happen September, roughly the end of the month, I think, on the 20th of September. But we actually still have arrangements with Russia. All the problems that are going on in Ukraine, the NASA and Roscosmos can't really stop their interactions with each other because the International Space Station controls so much on one side, solar panels and all of that. Russia on the other side, the tail end of the spacecraft, the space station. Controls propulsion primarily, for our people, which has to happen every now and then. The orbit, the air is kind of rarefied at some locations, so little tiny molecules from there. The space station is going 17,500 miles an hour, I think it was mentioned slow down the orbit. So, astronaut Frank Rubio will be traveling on Soyuz vehicle. To the space station, this deal is you always have to have Americans and Russians to get on the space station. It doesn't happen. You never want a space station just with Americans, but just with Russians. They've been able to accomplish that in 2000. We've got 20 years there, over 20 years. The human flight. Yeah, okay, and now there's also another crew that's going to be going up. Stand by. Crew Dragon. Dragon is going to be launched October 3rd, so Frank Rubio, the astronaut, will be coming up in September. A couple weeks later, there'll be a launch. Flying by a Dragon. Falcon 9 SpaceX vehicle, bringing four people up to the International Space Station. We have Commander Nicole Mann. She was actually supposed to fly on following Starliner. Starliner's mission again pushed back over time. We still haven't gotten the crew up to the space station yet, but they're working on it. But anyway, Nicole Mann was supposed to be on one of the first missions. Starliner, but NASA took her off and put her on to the second mission. So they made her to be commander, although she's never flown before. She's now commander of the next Dragon mission for October 3rd. They have a pilot, is Josh Cassiter, and then you have